Dag te kwijt, Augusta Valtjerov, is mijn aan Skellybjörg. Hallo en welkom, I'm Skellybjörg, little storyteller, and today we have a presentation on the Dagda's tools, or the good God's tech, and what it might mean to us. It's a presentation as part of the online Irish Pagan School, which I'm delighted to be a part of and present. Okay, so I'm going to take you through a presentation here. There's going to be a couple of sections for us, and we'll give you an overview of what's going to be happening. So section one, we're going to talk about the harp, which is one of his more recognized tools. We're then going to look at its various names. So Osgoelge in Irish, it's Uthne, Dorda Bla, or Ker Kar Kor. And I will be going into the translations on those later on. We're going to then move into section two about the club, the Lorg Mór, also known as Lorg Anfeha, or the Gobble Giga. So from there, we're going to move on into the third and notable item, the cauldron, which is Cora on Dagdi, or Coraineshuk is what it's also called. And then the last part is really what it means to me. So I'm going to take you into my personal view of these items, how I interact with them, and how I can consciously choose to engage with them. And then also a bit of a practical use, so something that I actively choose to do as I work with each of these tools. So as we go further on with the presentation, first things first is about me, a bit of an introduction if you haven't seen me before. I'm a writer and a storyteller. My work predominantly kind of circles around the Dagda himself and the Tuatha Dé Danann, so the ancient gods of Ireland, touching on the folklore and the mythology and engaging with that as an active pursuit for my own kind of spirituality, but also as an expression of creativity. I am also a presenter and an events host, so much like I'm presenting a course here now, but I've also been asked to present at other events as well, just to kind of facilitate where best I can, you know, host an MC. Tour guide. So I do stomp about the lands of Ireland, taking kind of tour groups across the island and kind of into different places and explaining some of the stories that kind of are connected to the landscape and kind of connecting and introducing people to what is outside of the standard norm, hopefully, of Irish tour experiences. And the last is one of my catchphrases, which is, it's not always easy to find the right words, but when we find the right ones, you can change hearts and minds. So that's a personal reminder to myself that I should always be looking for the right words because of the impact and the intent that that can happen as we move forward. And I'm responsible for that. So before we dive on in, stop. Beware all who enter here. From this point forward, you are entering into my mindscape. It's my experiences of the Dagda, and I'd always kind of caution, beware of the god. It's my kind of speculative and experiential reasoning based on the folklore as I kind of read through these ancient stories and kind of connect them in with my daily life and my practice and my work with him. Warning, personal gnosis ahead. So personal gnosis is not a bad thing if it's substantiated, if you can kind of connect it back to stuff and you're open and willing to have a discussion to challenge yourself about it. So there is something to be said for the validity of that once you're checking your sources and not just hanging it all out to dry on, well, this is my personal belief. So yeah, there's my kind of warning up front. From here on in, you're in John's Dagda Worldview. Opinions and perspectives are my own, so welcome to my mindscape. So section one, we're going to look at the harp. So we're going to analyze all these three sections in all of these sections regarding the items in three ways. We're going to look specifically at the lore and anywhere I can kind of pull out and reference the stories where these items appear, and the abilities, what it actually says in the stories that they're capable of doing, these unique tools, and then places in the Irish society or the language around how it's connected into those particular items. Okay. So the first is the harp, and I've got an image just on the right here. It's an artist impression. So you have a tall red-haired figure with a club in one hand, beckoning and summoning a harp off a wall of a feasting hall, and it's flying through the air towards him. Unfortunately, I can't credit the artist. I have dug around as much as I can. I think there's a note on there. Oh, there we go. Sarah Butcher from 2004. It's Sarah Butcher's work. And it's a lovely kind of expression of the story that we're going to look at right now. So what this tale tells us is that during Cath Mac Tuirre, or the Battle of Moytura, Part 2, so it's the Tuatha Dé Danann fighting the Fomorians over the kingship, or the wrongful kingship of Bress in Ireland, the Fomorian, a war band, kind of splinter off from the army. They specifically steal the Dagda's harp and they flee with it. Dagda, Oma, and Lou pursue them after the battle to try and recover his property, and they enter the hall. And this little segment here from the translations, I have Cross and Harris's translation up here, and I'm just going to read that out for you. There hung the harp on the wall. That is the harp in which Dagda had bound the melodies, so that they sounded not until, by his call, he summoned them forth. When he said this below, "Come, Dor Dablaw, come, Cor Cahar Cur, come, summer, come, winter, mouths of harps and bags and pipes." Then the harp went forth from the wall and killed 9 men and came to the Dagda. And he played for them the 3 things whereby harpers are distinguished, to wit, sleep strain, the smile strain, and the wail strain. So this is kind of the one of the more recognized images of the harp, and it's very, very clear what's happening here. He's recovering his item, and there's a mystical or magical element to it occurring as we go. The other mention that I found of the harp comes from this section here, which is in the Tonbo Freach. A lot of these stories kind of interweave the myths across the way, and it's hard to know exactly what connects where. And sometimes there's kind of throwbacks or kind of mentions to other stories that the audience really should be aware of in the larger scope of the lore. But what we have from Tonbo Freach is this record, and it says, "Gentle and melodious were the triad, and they were the chants of Uthne." And it translates this as childbirth. "The illustrious triad are 3 brothers, namely Galtreagus, the sorrow strain, Gentreagus, the joy strain, and Suntreagus, the sleep strain. Boan, from the fairies, is the mother of this triad. It is from the music which Uthon, the Dagda's harp, played that the 3 are named." So it's a later story on about the cattle raid of Freach, and it's mentioned this. These strains, these kind of things that harpers or performers would be able to do to prove that they are the best of the best. So it's a strain that would actually, the sorrow one, it would encourage people to weep and to grieve and to moan, and you'd be compelled to, you couldn't stop yourself. Then there's the joy strain, and it would be laughter, it would be bubbling up with emotions, and you'd revel and you'd laugh and you'd sing, again, you couldn't help yourself. And the last strain, which would be played, would lull you, calm you, soothe you into a restful sleep. So in the previous story, in the Battle of Moytura, Dagda performs these strains very clearly. And it's not the harp itself that does it. It's Dagda actually performs it. But he resolves the issue, not by descending in and kind of harming more people or engaging in the aggression of the fight, but by lulling and wooing until everyone has kind of felt their feelings, passed their emotions, and rested. So when I look at the harp, I kind of began to touch on it. So the first thing that it says there, it's bound to never play unless the Dagda allows it. Now, whether this is an ability of the harp itself, or whether that's something that the Dagda has done to this instrument, this tool, his tool of preference, he has bound the music into it so that no one can actually play it unless he summons it forth. It returned to the Dagda's hand when summoned by name. So he beckoned it, he called it by its identity, the power of the right words, the power of a true name, and he summoned it, and it leapt off the wall to return to his hands. The harp itself is said to have placed mortal wounds, which are killing wounds, on 9 foes as it moved through the air. So not only did it fly back to him, you know, maybe it's reminiscent of Mjolnir in the Norse mythology as well, but somewhere along the way, it flung itself around the room, and, you know, maybe as a balance, maybe the harp itself needed to take some kind of restitution for the fact that it had been stolen by claiming the 9 lives on the way back. There's another reference, and this is the last thing that we can say about it, specifically from the story there, is its name. It's Cor Cahar Cur, which is the rightness of 4 angles, which is this kind of correct and balanced shape. The 4 angles makes a square, generally. Maybe not, but it's this rightness of shape, enclosing a space, these 4 angles. But what it's believed, this translation, is that it would cause the turning of the seasons. So the Dagda connected with his abilities as a deity of weather and the deity of land and sea and sky, which we'll see. He is able to turn the seasons through this act of musical creation. Okay. So this is the part that I just wanted to touch back to there. It's the translation. So with the harp in hand, again, these aren't abilities of the harp. It's something that the deity performs. He proves himself an exemplar of this skill. Like the best of the best harpers have to be able to perform these three strains. And so the deity actually uses this particular tool to manifest those abilities, and it's very easy for him to lull a foe or to kind of just change the emotional landscape through the act of these here. Okay, so last in this section is to touch on the language surrounding the harp. So the first, again, I've taken these from what's known as the EDIL. So it's an electronic dictionary of ancient Irish language. So it's a compilation of areas where they're pulling it directly from the text. So this is not modern Irish in the main sense, but I do notify where I am kind of stepping over into that. Okay. So the first is Uthni, which we saw earlier on is, also childbirth. So there's, I'm running ahead of myself. I beg your pardon. Slightly nervous again about presentations, but we're going to rock on. So Uthni is translated as a post or a prop, a support or a pillar. So it's also labor, as in a woman's kind of childbirthing pangs. It's referred to as a suture, a medical suture for kind of bringing stuff back together so it can heal. Again, the next one is a junction or a union or a concord or a pledge, an agreement. And then the last is a concord in music. And when you get like a joining or a concord in music, it's two things coming together. So either you have dissonance as the noises clash against each other, or you have harmony where they come together in union. So it's very, very interesting to kind of pull those languages together to give us an idea as we move towards the latter part of how I specifically work with this. But the fact that Dainty is connected with childbirth, and this harp by its name is specifically connecting in with labor pains and the whole process. Those three strains are said in Tombo Fréach to be the noises that a woman would make as she is in the position of labor or in the giving birth process. So it's very interesting that that is actually connected with him as a deity. And again, it's this musical elements and this creativity of harmony. So the other name that we have here is Dor Dábhlá. So the first part is Dor, which can be translated as oak or a bulling. Daw, which is either to, good, or giving. And then Blá, which is fields, plains, or enclosures. It could be flowers or blossoms, or it could be a shout, a cry, or a report of resounding noise. So it could be translating this as the oak of two meadows, or the oak of two blossoms is what's generally kind of taken, but it could also be the oak giving a cry, giving a shout, which connects it back to the sound and the noise that it would create. So Cur Cathair Cur is broken down in these two kind of areas. The main kind of word of that is cor, which is a rightness. It's a justness and propriety. That is, which is correct, and that is, which is right due. It's also a procedure, a device, meaning like doing something. It's also something that's evenly proportioned. It's well proportioned or straight, or something that is proper, correct, or suitable or fitting. And then the Cathair Cur is that four-sided shape, be it a square or a rectangle, which when you combine those together is the rightness of that four-sided shape or the rightness of the balance as things move from one shape to the other. So it's very interesting to break down the words and what that can really tell us about the item itself as we kind of understand how it's named. So at this particular point, it's worth to mention that the language is very, very important, and it's a power that people would view very, very passionately and very kind of respectfully in the ancient Irish traditions. It was seen as something that was extremely important in the ancient society. Someone who had the ability to weave words or weave sound, would be able to kind of control what those sounds and what those words are meant about. The records, like bards or fila, would have to kind of have the remembering. They'd have to be able to recite the names or perform the specific feats, because that's what justified a person's right to rule, for example. They'd have to have their lineage kind of set out and remembered, and the people who would remember that would be the bards in that society. So some people would be trained from early age, and you'd either kind of move into, like, under the umbrella of druids and druidic practice almost, you'd have particular people for music, particular people for spoken word, be it Fila, and then you have particular people for legal practice, be it Brehons. So it's a broad kind of umbrella shape when someone says druid. But these people, all of these individuals who chose this path and chose this practice, were very, very skilled and very, very respected for what they did in general. And so it was by the power of these words and these performances of music and creativity that someone's merit could be established or destroyed. And there's a very, very clear precedent in the legal kind of records about satire. It was actually said that no king can rule Ireland if they have a legal satire placed against them. And a satire was a performance, a poetic and musical performance, which would actually declare them unfit for whatever it is that they're trying to claim to do. So against the backdrop of that, we have the Dagda, who has easily displayed all of these kind of abilities to fall within that rule of Fila and Bard, but also druidic circumstances as we move on to look at the next section of abilities. Okay. So if there's any questions at this point, maybe fire them into the chat, and I'll try to take a couple of few minutes in between each section. So let's have a quick look there. So Alistriana, hi. Love the hidden information that is found in each of these names. The Old Irish, from what era would this be from around? Curious, would this be pre-Christian or early Christian? The recordings that we have are from various manuscripts, but those manuscripts are all written down by Christian monks. So there's the Book of Fermoy, the Yellow Book of Lecan, the Great Book of Lecan, the Book of Leinster. These all contain these ancient stories. And a lot of these kind of large illuminated manuscripts are the records of the monastery or the monks who were filling it in, but they also kind of connected in with the local people and kind of put in page fillers. Oh, we'll just fill in, we'll write this story that they kind of picked up off the locals. So a lot of the stuff that we have is from the 11th century, the records that are still kind of easy to kind of experience, but those do make mention of previous versions to like the 9th century as well. But these stories do go back further. Ireland really had an oral tradition initially, and that's what was passed on. It was only as the Christianity began to move into Ireland that there was this record of writing things down. So I hope that gives you some kind of insight. But again, yeah, absolutely, the power of words, the power of language, and the really, really understanding the language and how that takes us through gives us more insight around what these items are, who the people are at the time, and how important it was. So if that is there, that's why I'm asking, because I think these words might also refer to the art of these manuscripts. Is that the right frame? Just a bit of an opinion. It's... The thing with ancient Irish is that contextually the words change based on where they linked in. And then what was often found as the person illuminating or writing in these words, they would have their inspirations and they'd kind of doodle in the corners, or they'd kind of draw their pictures, or they'd kind of fill in the imagery around it. So I personally believe that it would influence creativity, as has happened with me in many, many senses there, as I begin to write these stories and begin to explore the details a little bit more. Okay, so we're going to move on to section two. We're going to talk about the club or staff. And as we go, any kind of questions, do fire them into the chat and we'll take care of them once we meet the end of this section here, okay? So what can we say about Dagda's club or staff? So I have a picture on the right there. That's actually a lent of birch. Silver birch is actually sitting right beside me here. I picked that up a good couple of years ago, and it's still in exactly that state. Hasn't been kind of peeled or shed. My woodworking is not quite there just yet. My facilities, really. But the reason why I'm showing a staff is because of the translations, again, as we look through and we talk about this. So we're going to dive straight into the lore and what it says. We have an excerpt from the Yellow Book of Lecan, which is one of those stories, and it's a story specifically about how the Dagda retrieved the staff, the club of the staff. The background story is that Dagda's son Kermit dies at the hand of Lugh, who's currently the King of Ireland. So that kind of sets it somewhere around or post Moytura Part 2, the battle against the Fomorians, because again, Lew is king. But Dagda's son Kermit has a relationship, an extramarital affair, shall we say, with Lew's wife. Lew has problems with that, of course, and they come to conflict, and mortal wounds are placed upon Kermit. Dagda then, absolutely distraught by this, not having any way to restore life to his child, uses his powers of druidry to prevent all corruption of the body, to prevent it from decaying, and then lifts the body of the child onto his shoulders, this grown adult, and then leaves Ireland. So the story kind of takes him out. It says he goes off into the east and he meets three brothers. These brothers are carrying their inheritance from their father, and each of them has these magical items. The one that is of interest here is this story. So Dagda kind of asks them to tell him what are the properties of each of the items. And they tell him about the shirt, they tell him about the shield, but then they tell him about the staff. And it says, "This great staff that thou seest," said he, "has a smooth end and a rough end. One end slays the living, and the other end brings the dead to life." So that's a record of that. And Dagda asks for a lend of the staff. They hand it over. He then takes it and he places it upon them. He places the rough end on the three brothers and he kills them. He then uses the smooth end to restore Kermit, his child, to life. And one of the first things that Kermit does is to look at his dad and the bodies and go, what's going on here? And call his dad out to say, listen, that's not fair. That's not just. And so Dagda kind of uses the smooth end on the three brothers, restores them to life, and then he actually puts himself under an oath that, you know, he needs the staff to kind of go forward. He needs to kind of take on board this power of life and death. They ask what guarantees is he going to give about returning it. And he says, I swear by my power over the sun and the moon, the land and the sea. So it's pretty much the heavens and the earth. I swear by my power over all of that, that I will return this club. It then says that he takes the club, returns into Ireland with it, and by its power becomes the King of Ireland. So another reference that we have to the club in the stories is from the second Battle of Moytura. So this is where timelines aren't the easiest to kind of find out, because Kermit dies while Lew is king. But this one here, as this record that we have, it's the Stokes translation of Moytura, the Battle of Moytura, where Lew is kind of saying, what are you going to bring to the fight? You know, he's talking to all these champions and all these heroes. He's like, what are you going to do for me? And Dagda says, he's like, not hard to say. Quoth the Dagda, I will take the side of the men of Erin in both mutual smiting and destruction and wizardry. Their bones under my club will be as many as the hailstones under the feet of herds of horses. And then there's kind of gaps in the text because the translations aren't very clear. And then he says, where we meet, and then on the battlefield of Moytura. So at this point, Dagda is actually swearing himself in for the conflict against the Fomorians. And it mentions the club at that point. So it's another kind of specific reference, but it shows the power that he'd be able to bring to the fight, not only with wizardry, but actually with smiting and destruction, empowered possibly more by this club or staff. So the next notice we have, again, is it's actually on the run-up to the Battle of Moytura, where Dagda is kind of sent into the Fomorian camp to ostensibly kind of spy, to kind of find out what's going on, or to maybe kind of make peace or try and figure out what's going on. And as he goes in, you know, there's this very famous story about it. I won't recount it all, but he goes to Fomorians. There's an issue over hospitality. They make this huge king-sized cauldron of all this porridge and full goats and everything is thrown in, but then they serve it in a ditch in the ground. And, like, you know, Dagda is bound by the hospitality. He needs to kind of eat this out of a ditch in the ground. He doesn't fail, though. He kind of takes out this spoon or this ladle, which is supposed to be big enough for a man and a woman to lie down or sit down in, and he just tucks into it, and he finishes the entire thing. He says he actually scrapes the gravel from the bottom of the trench and then tells the Fomorians how it was a great meal, and his stomach is all swollen and distended, and he wobbles his way out of the camp. So by that action, there's no grounds for him breaking hospitality, so they can't claim a battle off his disrespect. But also, he kind of had to put himself through a lot facing Fomorian hospitality. So as he kind of leaves, we have this excerpt, and it says, behind him wheeled a fork, which required the effort of eight men. so that its track after him was enough for the boundary ditch of a province. Wherefore it is called the track of the Dagda's Club. So this is where the information about this slightly changes. Like it's referred to as a wheeled fork, but then in this couple of sentences later, the track of the Dagda's Club. But what actually happens as he's kind of dragging this staff, this item, this tool of his through the dirt behind him, kind of leaving the Fomorian camp, it actually is running up a big furrow in the ground, and it's this apportioning of the land, and it's this boundary ditch between provinces of Ireland. So we will be digging more into these a little bit further on, but this is where we're pulling out the excerpts from the lore. This last one that I have for you is actually very interesting, and it's found in the Metrical Dynhyanicus, which is a long segment of poems, which is known as the naming of places and things. And this one is, it's referred to as Mag Merhevna. My pronunciation is not the best, but this is the clearing of the plains that Dagda does. So this is connected to a story. It's the wooing of Etienne, where Aengus Og, Dagda's son, is kind of trying to arrange this relationship for his foster father, Midir. And he goes to Dagda and he's like, okay, well, I've been told that I need to clear out all this land. And Dagda's like, okay, well, give me a minute and I'll see what I can do. Of course, I'm paraphrasing. He didn't say it that way. But what the text says is that there was this segment of the land that was covered by either a whirlpool or the sea. There was this kind of like, you know, flooded area. And that there was a monster in that area. And the monster would actually drag, like, you know, people down, drag wires and armor down to the bottom and drown them. So into this moment, the Dagda comes and it says, the Dagda came with his mace of wrath in his hand and plunged it down upon the octopus and chanted these words, turn thy hollow head, turn thy ravening body, turn thy resorbent forehead, avaunt, begone. And so with this performance, with the mace, club, staff, this tool, he kind of pushes down upon the monster and he banishes the monster from the land. And as the monster recedes, it takes the sea, takes the water with it out off of Ireland. And that's where the plain of Merhevna is created. And it's one of those stories, like there's a lot of stories in the ancient lore about the creation of plains, the creation of kind of land, especially arable or agricultural land, because ancient Ireland was a primordial or primeval forest. And so there was a lot of kind of clearing of these plains. There's like the clearing of the plains for Tailtu. There's this, the clearing of the plains, you know, for Aengus. And it's that kind of almost making the land fit for agriculture, for kind of growth, for making food and supporting a settled community. And it's almost around the time where we see Dagda fulfilling that role of moving the people from a hunter-gatherer society, moving away from disparate tribes all over the place into a unified people who are living upon the land and living off the land, growing what they need, the early farming kind of period. So next we're going to look at the abilities. So talking about this particular item, the image on the left is actually an oak staff. So it's an oak staff, and the black and brown kind of coloration to it there is because it came from a branch which was in a bog. It had fallen into a bog and it was beginning to turn into bog oak. So this item is actually out by the back door. It's the probably a staple post by our home. And yeah, it's kind of in this semi state. It's a gift that was given to me, which I value greatly. So that's the image that we see there. So looking at the information that we have from the previous stories, we're talking about a club or a staff. It's said to have one key ability. So the key thing that's given to us by the original owner of the item prior to the Dagda picking it up is a smooth end, which restores life, which had been lost, and a rough end that takes it away. So that's very, very clear from the origin story. Like, you know, both aspects are demonstrated in that origin story as Dagda takes the item, uses it on the brothers who originally owned it, obviously the rough end, and then uses the smooth end to restore Kermit. He takes it up. He kind of takes on the item, having kind of experienced its power and kind of knowing that he has a need of it. And he gives a guarantee, the sun, moon, sea, and land. But he does go one step further with his oath, and he defines what he's going to do with it. So he binds himself not only to return the item, but also only that it kill my enemies and bring life to my friends. So this powerful deity, this individual of influence, you know, makes it very, very clear in a swearing kind of binding oath upon himself that that's all he will do with this item. And so this is what the item is given to us when we kind of take from that original tale. But there's a little bit more that we can see. If we begin to kind of pull out and tease out what happens in the other stories, there's a little bit more around this particular club or staff. From the tales, we can see that in the context of the Dagda himself, so he's received it in, and it's this power over life and death, rough end, smooth end. But then what he does with it isn't just the life and death, despite the fact what he's kind of said, killing his enemies and bringing his friends. It becomes a little bit more in the Dagda's hands. He uses it to create the boundaries and territories, the track of the Dagda's club. So this item with him defines borders, defines the land, and shapes the land. If we look at the run-up to Moitura Part 2, Dagda's actually put in almost kind of indentured servitude to Bress to build the rafts. So he's an earth shaper and he's a ditch digger at that particular point. So it fits with him to be able to use this item. And it's not just a case of, well, he kind of made a ditch on a field. This thing made a boundary between territories, establishing what those territories are. The mention of its forked nature, like, you know, this forked tool, when we combine that with the Dagda as a, what's known as a brigru or a brewer. A brewer is a very specific role within the ancient Irish society. A brewer was kind of the chief highest rank you could be within the farmer class. So it's not a king, it's very, very high in that particular class. There were certain rules that you had to adhere to if you were a brewer. You had to have cattle which was counted in the hundreds. Your home had to be at the crossroads of at least three, if not four roads. And if anyone came to your door, you had to fulfill their need for safety and for food and drink. And you couldn't turn anyone away. So it's that element of hospitality. But one of the tools specifically linked with a brewer is this fork, this kind of item where, you know, all of the meals are proportioned out, you know. And there's a later story which we'll touch on where the fork is used to give someone their just, their proportion, their exact portion, what they actually deserve. So the forked nature of this could link that in with the item in question as a brewer. We have a record there. The destructive powers of it are said to be terrible. So the translation terrible comes from, this pronunciation has stumbled me a couple of times. It's Adwathmar. That's probably wrong. Don't quote me on it. But it's this kind of word that means terrible. Like, you know, the use of this particular item is terrible. And when we see the story where he mentions, like, you know, I will kind of rain down upon them wizardry, but also smiting and destruction, and their bones will be broken like hailstones, that's pretty terrible as far as description of the power could go. Also, the next thing is this translation, this mace of wrath. The words that we use there, which we'll see in the translation tab next, because I have pulled those out of the text for exploration, could also mean tempest or storm staff. So again, connecting it back with the weather and with the control of the weather that the Dagda has, swearing himself just above there with his ability over sun, moon, sea, and land. The moon controls the tides influence the weather, the sun controls the clouds. It's all this kind of control of weather. And there's records and other stories where Dagda is specifically linked to good weather and the promotion of crop growth, or the promotion of kind of, you know, plentiful harvests and plentiful kind of milk from the cows and the grain. So this item, this staff or club in his hand, becomes an embodiment. He is almost using his own power through this item for this storm staff or race. But again, it's used to create new land, to create new arable land by banishing a monster from the plains so that those plains could then be used for agriculture. So the last point we have there, again, it's just a mention from that initial story, the origin story of the staff. Dagda claimed it when he actually took it on board and swore himself to his purpose for this. It says he comes back and he takes the kingship of Ireland using this item, and that he then rules for 80 years. Now, there's a lot of kind of connections with kingship and right kingship, and a lot of kind of circumstances of the tale a right ruler would have some kind of scepter or rod that would indicate that they, that is their implement, their tool of right kingship. So we have this, again, club staff coming into it as he uses the staff to claim the kingship of Ireland. So it almost fulfills that kind of purpose as this rod or scepter to show that he is the right kind of person to be king, you know, and that he is worthy of being king, given what trials he's gone through and how he has used it to define the territories and the boundaries, provide agricultural land, to restore the life of people who've been lost, and to defend those people and the land with its destructive powers when need be. So the last thing I have on this here before we drive into a bit more translations is the Dagda's staff is referred to as a lorg. Lorg is the Irish word for it, and there's additional kind of information or descriptions given in the names of the Dagda, which is a document done by Martin Scott in April 2008, and that's where the Udathamar comes from, which is terrible, but it's also referred to as Yardini, which is iron. So the time frames that we have for hunter-gatherer moving into early farmer, like early kind of Neolithic kind of circumstance, we're well beyond the Iron Age, but we have this kind of word which could be connecting it in with an iron item. So some of the elements of its mysticism may be the fact that it's a product that's, it's non-standard, having come from outside of Ireland. Maybe it is of a higher technological circumstance given the iron element. So the last one is the texts when we're talking about it, Cath Mag Tuath, the Battle of Mag Tuath again. It's mentioned as being a Gobblegicka Rothuk, which Gray translates as a wheeled fork. So I have the details of it there. So it's following the fork in the text, which is a document done by, again, same Martin Scott. So he kind of explored the translations done by Gray of the initial kind of stories of Cath Mag Tuath, and the translations of this Gobblegicka is a wheeled fork, but also the Gobblegicka is a little bit more than that as we jump into some translations. Okay. So the words we have, so Lorg Mór is in the origin story. So this is the great staff that we have. But Lorg could be a trace, a vestige, an impression. It could be a supporting staff, like as a crutch or an item to heal that way, almost. But Lorg could be an example, you know, a model, something that is a pattern of performance. It could be your progeny or your descendants. Again, it's staff, stick, rod, or wand of office. A club or a cudgel, as it's most commonly seen, but this is entertaining. In the online dictionary, as I mentioned, it's referred to as the membrum virile, which is pretty much a penis. So the lorg could be translated as the male genitalia, which again connects in with a lot of the descriptions around Dagda as a passionate person, a physical person, a sexual kind of person, with multiple children, this father of many, but it's kind of connected in with that as well. And some people do get hung up on that image of him in that way, especially when you move on to the next word, which is Mór, which is again great, big, but also it's not just size in this, it could also mean great as in mighty or famous, you know, or to think much of, or to have esteem or value. So when you're looking at Lorg Mór, you know, it could be a great staff, but it could also be, you know, a little bit more than that. It could be something of high esteem or a value. It could be an impression or, you know, a valuable impression that's been left. The next one is the Gobblegicka, as I mentioned. The Gobblegicka turns up in connection with brewers. So this is that hospitality rank I mentioned earlier on. And it's this kind of forked or pronged pole that would be pretty much the mainstay, the main support kind of item, the main tool of use for a brewer. So gobble, the word itself, is something that's forked, a forked branch of a tree, or a forked beam supporting like a shaft or a building, in essence. It's also referred to as a weapon, a pronged spear. And again, the connected to the anatomy, it's the fork of the body or the thighs where they fork into the body. So it's as I mentioned with the language, the wording kind of changes as it flows through. And as you kind of put the words together, you know, gobble then moves a little bit further when you put gicka to it. And a gobble gicka becomes a forked or pronged pole or beam or staff. So next we have Lorg Amphia. Amphia comes from Anfid, which is a tempest or a storm. Or it could be a turbulence or fury or a rage. So this is that Mace of Wrath kind of reference. So is it a storm staff of some sort that he used to actually banish out the weather, to control the weather and make the land? Or is it actually something that would fuel rage and fury in order to drive someone to the point where they could do great deeds? We don't know. And those last ones there is the Lorg Audismar Iridini, which again, the first one is the very awful or terrible. So that's the destructive qualities that have been mentioned. But also the Iridini is iron or made of iron, an iron implement or fitting weapon, fetter or mail or armor. So it gives a bit of an understanding like this, given the story, like to bring in the fact that it's made of iron, I think that's later as far as the documentation goes, but it could be that it came from outside of Ireland. There are kind of different timelines for technological advancements all around the world. And this is not a product. It's not an item. It's not a tool that was terrestrial or native to Ireland itself. So who knows? So that kind of takes us through that. Just a worth of note, the point there at the end is the term gobble gicka is linked with that role of the brewer, this hospitality kind of item. Okay. So that brings us to the end of section two. I know I've been talking quite a bit. Hopefully it's not kind of running too far for us. Do we have any more questions at this particular point? Do fire them into the chat there, and we'll take a couple of quick minutes to review them. Have a look. Okay. So thanks, Alistrina. The nuances of the Irish language, it does really tell a lot. And there's a lot to be kind of said as you kind of connect and explore the meanings of the words and the broad variety. Now, of course, a friend of mine, Morgan Daimler, they have a terrible time kind of going through it. I've had conversations with Chris and Isolde of Story Archaeology. Both of those groups of people are amazing, and really you should support them if you can, or experience their work. Story Archaeology stuff is available on kind of free podcasts to listen to. But from a point of view of delving into the ancient Irish lore, it can be such a bother because there are so many different variant meanings of the words as you kind of link them back to each other. And then as you stick more words close to them, the meaning can change. And then there's the fact that there was such a challenge with the language I use the word challenge that way, but there was a loss of our language. For a while, a good long while in Ireland, I'm seeing Laura in the chat as well. Hi. The language was outlawed. So like you weren't allowed. It was against the law to speak Ireland because we were Irish in Ireland because we were under the oppression of a foreign power. So what could have been a colloquialist turn of phrase, which everyone would have known, like on Lorg Mór or Lorg Anphia, would have a different meaning that everyone would just understand because it was a cultural turn of phrase. That may be lost now because what we have is kind of people of a certain educational standard looking back into the information and trying to kind of break it down to kind of find these words. So to the best of their ability, we get a lot, and it's hugely valuable to have that. But there's probably more that we will never be able to reclaim. Again, it's that local kind of experiential knowledge that people would be living the language that would have. Okay, so let's just have a quick look there. Okay. Yeah, awesome. I'll come back to those questions just towards the end, Alistrina, if that's okay. We'll dive on there because I'm realizing it's 9:45. So we've got two more sections to get through. Hopefully shouldn't be too much problematic. And actually, this is one of the shorter segments. So the cauldron. What can be said about the cauldron? Now, I've got two images here. One is a copper cauldron. In a picture, like photographed in a lake. It's a beautiful thing. The bottom picture is a leather cauldron, which is boiling over a fire. So who's to say what this vessel actually is? Because it's hard to say for sure, because we don't have much of a record. In fact, the only records I could find trolling through all of the information, and this was this line, you know, in a couple of different documents. This one is from McAllister's translation of Lara Gabala Éireann, I apologize, from 1941, and it says, from Murias was brought the cauldron of the Dagda. No company would go from it unsatisfied. So Lara Gabala Éireann is the book of the invasion, the book of taking of Ireland. So this translation is where we see a mention of this cauldron. Also, there's a second Battle of Moytura segment where, again, it's mentioned, and this is the Whitley Stokes translation. It says, out of Murias was brought the Dagda's cauldron. No company ever went from it unthankful. So both of these are talking about the return of the Tuatha Dé Danann to Ireland, and they're talking about the four treasures of the Tuatha Dé Danann, and that's where this is listed, this one item. And we have it here just from the Yellow Book of Lecan, this source, and it's the four jewels of the Tuatha Dé Danann, done by G.E. Stechart in 1930. And I won't try and read the Irish, but it's, again, and from Murias was brought the cauldron of the Dagda. And then never went an assembly of guests away unsatisfied from the cauldron of the Dagda. So we have the connection to the place, Murias, that it came from. We have it being mentioned as this core, that's the word core there. Like the first line is from the Irish version there, it's Murias took out core on Dagda. They brought the core, the cauldron of the Dagda in Dagda. And that's it. That's as much as I've been able to find trolling through all of this as I'm working it, because the descriptions that we have do not go into any more information. It's never kind of revisited. It's never said like what happened with the cauldron or how often. It literally just said that there's a cauldron. It's the Dagda's cauldron. And then anyone who came to the Dagda's cauldron always went away unsatisfied. Never went away unsatisfied. Always was satisfied. So what abilities can we say the cauldron has? Never went an assembly of guests away unsatisfied from the cauldron of the Dagda. That's it. That's all we have specifically about the Dagda's cauldron in the stories that I have been able to pull out to date. Of course, I'm still going to keep looking. The image on this, like here, is a large kind of curved stone with engravings around the outside of it. And this is the Stone of Noth. It was actually inside the passage tomb there. So again, could be a grinding, could be some kind of cauldron stone, but you know, not the actual Dagda stone. So what I've been going through and looking at is, if we don't know anything more about the cauldron, what more can be said about Murias, which is the place it came from? So in the Four Jewels of the Tuatha Dé Danann, this story, it mentions the four great cities from the islands in the north where the Tuatha Dé Danann came. And it says that there were four great sages. And in each city, there was a sage, and each sage had one of the treasures. And so there was like Phalias and the Lea Fall, the stone of like kings came from there, the stone of sovereignty. There was Gorius and Findius. And from each of those, like there was the sword, which is given to Noada, that no enemy would be able to stand against it. And then there's a spear that was given to Lu that, you know, no one would be able to kind of get to that. Yeah, pretty much no one would be able to succeed against the person with that spear or succeed against them. So they would always be victorious with that spear in hand. But the cauldron came from Murias. And what this kind of poem says is that Murias, it's just mentioned in two lines, Murias of great prowess from which battles were won outside. And then about a stanza later, it says, Semias, who was the prophet or the seer or the wise one or the empowered individual in Murias. It says Semias was in Murias, and it's referred to as the fortress of pinnacles. So in this story, we have this bountiful cauldron that would satisfy anyone's need coming out of a fortress of pinnacles from which battles were won outside. So this defended, secure space that no one could get into because battles were always on the outside. No one got inside. And they had this plentiful abundance from this cauldron. So it's interesting to me. And I plan on pursuing Murias a little bit further on because it does have an importance to me, which we'll see a little bit later on. But the other things that I can say about cauldrons is this record I hear. It's a notice from a treatise, a breakdown, a kind of investigation done by an O'Sullivan in 2003, not this O'Sullivan, and no relation to my knowledge. But it does say the brewer valued his cauldron not only as a household item used for preparation of food for a feast, but also as a symbol of wealth and status. A brewer was expected to maintain his cauldron in constant use to satisfy all comers. So ainshuk is the word that's used there, but it can also be glossed or kind of viewed as bith fulloch, always wet, or bith lawn, always full. So the inability or the refusal to serve someone who came would cost the brewer their status, would mean they would lose their title, they'd lose their position. So if we kind of remember the diet is connected with this hospitality because of the cauldron and the symbolic nature of brewers around that, it's also connected with the gobble gicke, which is this pronged fork that would be used to serve out or give people their portions. You know, it's fair to say that, you know, the diet is a top-notch brewer because not only does he have a cauldron which always has to be kept wet, never dry, always has to be kept full, and everyone who comes has to be fed, his particular cauldron is guaranteed to feed everyone. No one is going to go away unsatisfied from it. So the last part here is a tale. It's Dahos Pig is a separate tale entirely, but the reason why I pulled this in, because it talks about the gobble gicke. It talks about this flesh fork, this feeding fork. And I would say every man would thrust the flesh fork into the cauldron, and whatever he brought out at his first catch was his portion. And so it's this interaction with the tools, with the implements. You take this flesh fork, this gobble gicke, you'd put it into the cauldron, and then you'd pull out exactly what you're supposed to have in keeping with your merit, in keeping what you're supposed to be sustained on. So it's as much as we identify the diet with this vast cauldron of abundance, the lore only says that he has it and it came from Urius. So the language and the words that we have around this, we have Cor an Dagdi, which is the mythical cauldron of plenty, which is what's directly connected to the Dagda. We have Cor Ainshuk, which is Cor, which is cauldron or pot. Ainshuk is an epithet, which is always linked in with a cauldron. And it could be, as I said, there could be also replaced with or glossed into Bith Fulloch, which is always wet, or Bith Lawn, which is always full. Interestingly enough, there's another version, like another spelling. If we add in the fada, which is the little accent over the O, it goes from core to core, which could also be another like spelling of it is C-O fada or A-E. And that word actually means correctness or proprietary or justice, a lawsuit, a claim, peace, amity, or concord. Now, if we kind of remember back to the mention of the harp, the harp is called Cor Cahir Cor. So it's the rightness of four angles. So we have the cauldron, which is called Cor, and we have the harp, which is called Cor, both of which are about rightness and propriety and balance. When we look at the club, it is a tool of balance. One end kills, one end restores life. So it's about that rightness, and also it's Dagda's rightness to rule when he returns to take our Erland. Now, I do have one other section here before we wrap off this part, and the modern Irish. So Cor, this C-O father I-O-R, has moved and is still used in modern Irish, and it's still, to this day, used in connection with justice and equity, or with your proper share, what is due to you, what you're entitled to, a proper provision or accommodation. So, you know, again, when you go to a place, what is your proper just meal and proper kind of, you know, place of accommodation or place of stay, and condition. So proper condition, but also proper equipment. So using the right tool for the right job. So this is that word for core. And you know, I don't see the Dagda being in any way upset how the link of the cauldron, this core and Dagda, has moved down to this correctness and the balance as we move over to your correct equipment, correct condition, and your proper share, what's due to you. Okay, so we're going to dive into the last section, and this one is going to be a little bit heavy on my view of things, and it is going to be an exploration of kind of everything I learn and everything I work with when I visualize and embody these tools as best I can. So before we do that, we'll just take another couple of few minutes there. And any questions at this point, fire them into the chat, you know? So let me just go back there. Alistrina, hi, absolutely. It's like stepping through a doorway, completely new understanding. So it's your understanding of things. Oh yeah, and thank you very much, Alistrina, for your support on Patreon. Really do appreciate it. I know your circumstances may not be great, but I really, really do appreciate that you would choose to support my work and Laura's. It allows us to do this. You know, it's a support of the community through Patreon, through kind of book sales, through these kind of works that allow us to keep kind of reviewing this content and bringing more and more forward. So, you know, tip of the Bailey's coffee mug to you as well. And cheers on the cauldron for you as well. Which, my good friend, the copper cauldron. Yeah, so as seen in the photographs earlier on, someone brought it into Ireland and I'm the keeper of that cauldron now. So I do take care of it as best I can. Sally, hi, nice to see you. Yes, it knocks for me. Out of nowhere, I'd be wandering past, walking through a room, and the cauldron, the hook or the circle on the front of it would just start clanging off the cauldron. We don't have a creaky house. It's not a wobbly house. It just starts hammering itself to call for its attention, I suppose. And invariably, it means that I need to refresh his beverage as much as my beverage. And probably just needs to take some time out and take some attention to look after the business. Let's see. Okay. All right. So if there's no other questions, there is one there. Amazing. Yeah. Okay. So it seems that everyone who was gifted a tool was King of Ireland. Is that the case? The Leofall wasn't given to anyone specifically, but the Leofall was used to acknowledge the Kings of Ireland. Nuada was the first king. He steps aside for Lugh to become the king. Dagda does become the king. He actually rules. He's the one who's actually, it specifically says in the stories that he ruled for 80 years. And I've got some stuff that I will touch on as we move into section 4 and some theories, which we'll kind of come to just at the end, about his right to rule and his kind of position as king. But that's a very, very interesting one, this kind of version of sovereignty and all of these people who are all of these empowered named heroes with these kind of four magical items or attributed or associated with these magical items invariably lead their people or become the king. So it's a very nice one there. We're just at it there, 10 o'clock. I'm gonna take another sip. I'm gonna dive on into section 4, and I'll ask you to bear with me on this one because this part was tricky. I'll explain why in a minute. Okay, so section 4, what it means to me. So each of these items are very, very powerful, very cryptic, very full of information, very kind of hugely represented in our ancient stories, but also in our new media. There's a lot of people who are kind of connected to it and they mean a lot. So for me, I've had to find my way through these stories and find my way to address what they mean for me. And then also to understand how I work with that, how I kind of take that on board and, you know, make that part of my practice, make that part of how I manage my life through the use of these tools. So what I'm going to try and do is take you through that now. It's very, very personal to me, but a lot of people ask me about this kind of stuff and I've just figured it out and I've just done it as I need to do it. And so kind of bringing this presentation to this physical manifestation, this point, was a new challenge for me because I needed to kind of take a moment to step back from the stuff that I just do because it feels right to me to how do I explain what I do in such a way that would make sense, you know? So hopefully we can kind of go through this one at a time and give you a bit of an understanding as how how John interacts with these tools. So, the harp. What it means to me. The harp symbolizes the balance of emotional states and how keeping them in right order leads us to a harmony within ourselves. So, how I work with the harp specifically, that kind of connectedness, the stories talk about the three strains, the stories talk about the wailing strain, the sleeping strain, the joyful strain. They acknowledge emotion in all of these circumstances, but the harp itself is connected with core. Remember that core character, the rightness of four angles. So it's that right order of things. So for me, it's that emotional, managing my emotional states to keep them in that area of balance allows me to stay in right order within myself, in a state of harmony. So how I do this is first by acknowledging that every feeling is valid, yet also temporary. So like in the stories, Dagda plays the wailing strain and people cry. They absolutely grieve. They mourn. They full on heave their emotions out of them. But in the moving of the song, he changes it to the joyful strain, and the emotions of sadness, the emotion of grief leaves the people. And then it's joy, it's revel, it's ahas, with Irish for laughter, and happiness, or Irish for happiness. But people are like jubilant. But again, the music changes, that emotion moves away, and people then sleep and they rest. So the lesson that I take from the harp is that every emotion is valid, but every emotion is temporary. The next thing is that I'm neither defined nor controlled by my emotions, but I'm responsible for the impact they have on the world around me. So I kind of looked at the Irish language on that one, and the way you say I'm happy in Irish, current modern Irish, is ta áthas orm, which translate as the happiness, ta áthas, happiness, orm, is on me or upon me. If you say I'm sad, ta brón orm, the sadness is upon me. The same way that you say I'm hungry, ta ukris, the hunger is on me, orm. So the language that we have acknowledges the fact that the state, the emotional state or the hunger state or the thirsty state is temporary. The person is not hunger. The person is not sad. The person has sadness on them. And understanding that with the harp has allowed me to acknowledge the fact that, you know, I may have these emotions. They are valid. They're temporary. But I'm not defined by those emotions. I am not the embodiment of happiness. I am not the embodiment of sorrow. You know, I can be and will be happy and sad, and they will pass in time. I can be angry. Tafara gurum, the anger is upon me. You know, but again, it's temporary. It moves away. But the thing that I add to that at the end of that process is the fact that it doesn't define me. I'm not controlled by that emotion, but I am responsible for the impact that it has because it is mine. It is on me. And so if I'm jubilant and joyful and happy and everyone around me is laughing and I'm sharing that with people, great. I have to acknowledge the fact that I'm having that impact. You know, but if I'm sad, if the sadness is on me, the brone, or and that's influencing or connecting people or kind of taking them down, again, my impact is such that I'm responsible for that around me. You know, don't take it on board, but acknowledge how my emotional states can influence other people and be responsible for that. So what I actually do is I invest time trying to consciously spot and track my emotions and scenarios or circumstances that can influence them. So much like the harp, much like, you know, the music is played, you know, and this particular song happens or this particular, you know, strain is played and that triggers the emotional, you know, I play a game with myself. I try and spot that, you know, if I'm ever wound up over something, I try and have a habit of some part of my brain going, what are you feeling now, John? What emotion is this? And by consciously being aware, by consciously owning and being aware of those emotional circumstances, I'm able to then best decide how they should influence, how they should be used. You know, so if there's particular things that are happening around it, if there's particular circumstances that make me happy or particular circumstances that make me sad or make me angry, you know, I need to be aware of what that is and track how it is so I can manage those feelings should that scenario happen again or that circumstance happen again, you know. And then knowing that's the other way around, like, you know, managing my own brain in a way. If there's a song that just makes me tap my feet and dance, if I want to tap my feet and dance, play the song, which is my practical stuff that I do. The last thing, again, it's I invest time in things which I know can help and support or alleviate particular emotional states. So music. I've got playlists for any emotional state that I work with, reading, socializing, or silence. Sometimes the healthiest thing that I need, you know, is quiet. So take the harp and allow it to be quiet. Allow for the silence to happen or allow for the sleep, you know. So my personal motto, which many people have heard me say and probably will hear me say again for the harp, my personal motto is you got to feel your feelings. Just got it. So the practical use for this tool, as I kind of visualize and work with this harp, with this influence in my life, again, I have a music playlist designed for various emotional needs. So if I need to feel sad or if I'm feeling numb and I need to feel something, I can play. And I invariably jump through a couple of playlists and say, okay, no, this is the emotional thing that I need right now. You know, but I also engage in stillness and breathing exercises, you know, acknowledging that the emotion on me at that time, so this is that awareness, this is that practice, you know, taking a moment, exhale, inhale, whatever mindfulness works for you, but taking that time to get to the point of saying, okay, well, I know what I'm feeling right now. I'm aware that this is what this emotion feels like to me. This is what this emotion does to me. And so I can then work with that, allowing it to be for what it is in that time frame, but then allowing it to pass. I don't need to hold on to happiness if I don't need to be happy. I don't need to hold on to my sadness. You know, I can let that go and be ready for the next emotion. I don't need to hold on to my anger. I need my anger at times. We all do. You know, if things aren't right and if things are just, our anger is there to help us deal with that. But we can't just stay angry all the time. We need to allow for the anger to be and allow for it to pass. And through that, we then allow space for the next emotion to arrive. But again, that will too pass. And as you acknowledge the emotions are transient above, you begin to understand, I began to understand what is me, what I actually am. If I'm not defined by my emotion, then what does define me? If emotion is going to move on in the next moment to be something else, what underneath is still John? And that's a work of a lifetime, a work I always recommend. So that practice, that kind of breathing, that mindfulness moment, saying, okay, well, no, this is sadness or this is happy, you know, especially in acknowledge your happy emotions, acknowledge your up emotions as much as you acknowledge your down ones. You know, if you can take a moment to catch a breath and be like, I feel happy right now. You embed that in, you own that. And the next time you have that feeling, it will remind you like, you know, yeah, I have happiness. I feel happy. You know, we do have a lot of things that put upon us these days. And there's a lot of like, oh, well, no, it's a down day and it's an angry day. There's a lot of stuff that causes those negative things. But there are stuff in your life, in all of our lives, in all of our days, that causes that little bit of plus, those plus points. And when you have that awareness of what your emotions are, how they feel upon your form, then you'll know what the next thing is to choose that emotion. You know, you know what kind of feeds and connects that properly. You know, and with the awareness of those comes control. You know, you can't control something you're not aware of. And so when you're aware of your emotional states, when you're aware of your emotional triggers, I have found that I'm able to better control and choose clearly what act to take on it. So I'm not controlled by my emotion, but I can then choose what is the right action to take in line with that emotion to best suit the situation. You know, so if I'm in a state of sadness, you know, if the depression is upon me, you know, I can acknowledge that. I won't kind of get stuck on that, but I acknowledge that that is where I am right now. So I can make a conscious decision to say, okay, well, you know, I won't push myself into social circumstances where I'll just bring it down or drain myself more. You know, I will make a choice to silence or music or reading, you know, something creative. Or if I am in a plus point, if I am happy or bouncy, then, you know, I'll acknowledge that and I'll say, okay, well, you know, I'll check in with other people around me. Am I going to cause a disruption for them? Are they in a state that would be comparable with me? Can we both revel and dance together? Or do I need to kind of find some other way to express that without pushing my happiness on other people? You know, which can happen sometimes too. So the HARP for me is, as I said, emotional balance, emotional well-being, but also the right order that leads to a harmony of self. Okay. So the next one is the club. I think I'll take a quick sec just to have a look at the chat there in between each one of these, and it'll give me a moment to drink some water as well. So, Alice, Adrian out there, so it's a powerful way to look at what flows through us naturally, and being responsible for it. It's too easy to let emotions get blocked or kind of bottled up inside, or let them slip out irresponsibly. Yeah, it's, again, you can't control something you're not aware of. So practice the awareness of it, and then you have control. And if the choice at that point is, I need to lose control, then you can choose that. You can choose whatever action is needed. You know, if it's a case where, you know, there's something, there's an injustice happening that needs righteous response or righteous anger, then you can righteously choose to deal and be empowered by your anger in that moment because it's the right thing to do. So it's not lashing out with uncontrolled circumstance. It's lashing out with very, very controlled circumstance. And that, I have found, is very powerful, which is why I'm very, very careful about that, responsible for my actions. Which leads us into the next item on our list, which is the staff/club. Responsibility. What it means to me, it represents the responsibility of my power and the impact that I have upon the world. So I have a tattoo on my arm. It has all three of these dagger tools upon it. And it reminds me every time I look down at that club that I'm responsible for my power. In the same way that one end, rough end, smooth end, you know, it's all me at the end of the day. The power itself is neither right nor wrong, neither good nor bad. My choice is what defines that. What I do with it is what defines that. And so the staff to me is representative of that power and the impact it can have on the world. How I choose to work with it. The first is, it's actually pretty hard. It was very, very hard for me to do. It's to accept that I have the ability to do both right and wrong, help and harm. And so I acknowledge that I'm responsible for the impact of that, regardless of the intent I may have. Takes a lot of time to come around to that. Took me a lot of time to get around to that, to get to the point of saying, okay, well, you know, I'm not good. I'm not bad. I'm me. I have power. I have ability. I have agency. I have choices, you know, and it's by my choice that is right or wrong. It's by my decision. Irrespective of my backstory, you know, irrespective of what are the challenges or issues, when it comes down to something I choose to do, when it comes down to something that I have an impact, I'm responsible for that. Even if my intent was the greatest intent in the world, you know, oh, I never meant to hurt you, never meant to whatever, still did. You're responsible for the impact. And so the club to me represents that. The power that comes with that and the responsibility of carrying that. Next thing I do when I work with the club is I choose to view the power as a function of purpose and set myself very clear boundaries around its use. So much like what the doctor did when he took up the staff, he bound himself to a purpose. He knew he was taking on this power of over life and death, adding it into all of these other powers that he already had. but he bound himself to that purpose. And he said, this is what I will do with it, you know, for these reasons. And so when I think about the staff, when I think about this responsibility of my power, I also think about clear boundaries, very clear understandings of what I'm going to do, in what way am I going to do it. And that is it. That is what's established. That's it. Also means that I find personally with my work with this, it's a little bit more effective. You know, I'm not just pushing power in every different directions, pushing myself, you know, in, you know, energetically out there or emotionally or like, you know, intellectually, because that's what I mean by power. I'm not talking about some mystical kind of elements here. Like, you know, all of it is the same, you know, it's just a different way of manifesting it. So the staff to me is power being a function of purpose and setting those boundaries around it. As well, to establish clear boundaries about what I hold to be true regarding my principles, though I maintain an openness around discussing those principles to ensure that they are keeping with my best self. So the benefits of the staff, again, is that boundary, this territory. This thing can be used to define provinces. So when I look at it, I look at it to define the landscape of me. I choose my principles. I'm very, very clear about that. And then I use or view this boundary, this kind of tool to make the boundaries around that and say, okay, well, this right here, you know, this is me. Irrespective of my emotional states, which come and go, the core, deep down, inside, I know what that is. And so I draw a boundary around it with the staff. And that's it. You know, that helps me protect myself, helps me be sure of where I stand and what I stand for and why I stand for it. But again, the staff has two ends. So there's no point having, like, it's good to have principles. It's good to fully understand yourself and know where you are. But don't close yourself off against openness of discussion around your principles. You know, sharing that, like, you know, I have come from a circumstance where it was not a healthy relationship, you know. Could be viewed as an abusive relationship. Manipulated, controlled, talked down to. That is fact. That is past. So one of my principles is that I will not allow myself to be in that again. I will not allow someone tell me that I am irrelevant again. And if they find me irrelevant to them, that's fine. They can be elsewhere, but I'm relevant to me. And that is something a very, very clear drawn boundary around. And I'm willing to talk about that. Absolutely willing to share my story with other people. And if someone has a different insight, if someone has a different perspective, then I can take that on board. You know, a principle is something that you hold to, but it should never be so rigid as you're not open to discussion about it. Because what we're all seeking here is our best self, the best version of ourselves for our life. And so the club and the staff allows me to draw those boundaries and be very, very clear around, well, this is what I view as my best self. That might change. It might change as I get more information in, but I'll still have that boundary around it. And that allows me to kind of have a very clear identity of self and not be drawn too much to fulfilling other people's perceptions. Hard one. Very hard one for me, that one. The last one there is, yeah, also a very hard one. Acknowledge that I will always be an example of some kind. So I choose to be the best example I can be whilst remaining as humble as I can. This one comes back to the naming, the Lorg Mor, you know. So is it a big staff or is it a good example? So I know people are going to look at me, or my friends look at me, like, you know, family members, young nieces, nephews, you know, look up at me, because at the moment I'm still taller than them, thankfully. But anyone we interact with, we're always looking for information around whoever we interact with. And so it's going to happen. People are going to look and say, okay, well, you know, is that someone that I want to connect with or work with? Is that someone that I want to understand or view or learn more about? And they're going to look for that. and I'm in a position where people do. So I make the choice. I make the choice to be the best example I can be. But again, the staff has two ends. I'm not going to let myself overindulge in the ideas of that, and I'm going to try and remain as soft and humble as I can. A soft end, rough end, soft end. And my personal motto for this, for the staff or club, is just John. Practical use for this tool. I've been doing this for a while, but again, writing it down like this really helped me kind of bring it forward into what I actually do. At times, I intentionally visualize the staff or the club in relation to a situation and ask myself, does it need the rough or the smooth end? Once I've made the decision, I move forward, accepting all the consequences as mine to manage. If I'm in a bind, if I'm kind of looking at something not able to, like, it needs an action, but I don't know which way to go with this, I imagine visualize the staff, club, whichever way it wants to, it's moving into staff in my mind, given my explorations and the language. And I visualize the rough end and the smooth end, or whichever way, left or right. And then by putting that against the problem, the challenge, the circumstance, the scenario, it allows me almost to measure what would be the best resolution here. You know, what would be the best way to view it? So it's to say, okay, you know, doesn't need rough end, you know, doesn't need like harsh, hard energy, doesn't need toughness, or doesn't need soft, smooth, doesn't need like, you know, gentle, you know, which end is best. But then once I make that decision, go forward with it. You know, I'm holding the staff. I'm empowered by it. It is my power. I am responsible for that power. So whatever comes of that decision, it's mine to manage. And accepting that responsibility means that I can make those decisions and go forward. Because whatever comes next, I'll make the next decision and go forward. Which, again, is a tricky one for me, because I do can in the past have gotten stuck in a rut out of fear. So the staff helps me to manage that, to feel a power, to make a decision, and to do it. The next one actually comes from that fear, you know, the other visualization of the staff. I imagine it, I visualize it in my hand. And I plant it in the earth, and then draw a boundary around myself. Pull it around, surround myself with a boundary within the ground, within the earth, within the energy around me, within any space I happen to be. And I kind of carve that boundary around myself or other people, depending on what's needed. And the purpose of the space within that boundary, again, depends on which end of the staff is used, the rough end, the gentle end. So it's something that allows me to be very, very clear again, to set those boundaries around myself, to set something that I want to have clear space for, or if I need to clear space off against something else and say, okay, well, you know, sorry, this needs to be given its space to sort itself out, you know, and just need to be very clear around what is in and what is outside of that space. And that's one thing I visualize and use with the staff. So we're going to move on to the cauldron. We may run a few minutes over time, so I hope it's not too much of a bother for people. But are there any questions at that point in regards to the staff for the club? Okay, no, great. Okay, so we're going to drive on into the cauldron. Cauldron is a tricky one because there's not a lot that was given to us from the lore. So this is one that I kind of take from what the cauldron means, from the symbol of the cauldron. So what it means to me is hospitality, an acceptance of what is right and justly deserved for labors undertaken. satisfaction can mean more than a full stomach. So from our exploration, the cauldron was the centerpiece of a brewer's household. Brewer had to accept hospitality, accept any request for hospitality, and offer safe space, a good meal, and comfort. And that, to me, is so hugely important for a society, especially for society which is only forming, for community which is only coming together. All these disparate tribes, all these different kind of kings in different provinces, you know, battling against each other, raiding against each other. If there was not one safe, neutral space where people can have a good meal, come together without conflict, and talk, then we wouldn't have ever gotten to the point of having an interconnected society. So hospitality is very, very important, and it's something I work very hard at for me. So at the Cauldron, the work that I do is I do what I can to provide the best hospitality within my means to anyone who comes to my home or any space I manage. Wherever I happen to be, you know, if it's like, you know, join me for dinner, sit down. If I'm cooking this, if it's a sandwich, if it's a cup, as simple as a cup of tea, if it's simple as a glass of water, whatever hospitality is, it doesn't have to always be food or drink. You know, it could be as simple as, here, come on in, have a sit down, take some heat off my fire, like, you know, take some company, take some, you know, conversation or some silence, companionship. You know, hospitality is more than just a full stomach to me. So I acknowledge that, you know, I want to give that. You know, I want it to be a space where people can come wherever I happen to be and feel that they're going to be getting taken care of and that they will find a satisfaction in whatever way. I work consciously to be open and giving with of what time and what energy I have for those who come in need of it. So the Cauldron is this overflowing outpouring of abundance. It's this giving of what people need. You know, if we combine that with the gobbledygooker, with this kind of pronged fork, you know, you stick in your fork and you pull out and you get exactly what you need, what you're due. So for me, I try and embody that energetically. Someone comes to me and they want to have a conversation. Someone comes to me and they just need, you know, something I can give. I will absolutely do the best I can for them. Next one is, again, I believe that satisfaction can be a function of more than just physical needs. I try to acknowledge that and offer what mental and emotional supports I can. So the Cauldron was always a centerpiece of any home or house. It would always sit above a hearth. A hearth is the warmth place, the warmest place in the house. It's a place of activity. It's a place of connectivity. It's people coming together, sitting around the warm fire, you know, putting in what they have into the pot to get their meal out of it. Like, it's a place of focus and it's a place of shared space. So it's not always about a full stomach. You know, sometimes you can eat all the food around you and it's not going to satisfy you because that's not what you need. That's not what your body needs. You know, it might be a spiritual lack, or it might be an emotional lack, or it might be a mental something or other that is causing a lack of satisfaction. And so looking for fitting those, looking for what the lack is and serving what is needed to meet that lack leads to satisfaction. There's no point, you know, handing a glass of water to someone who's not thirsty, you know? So it's a matter of acknowledging that satisfaction is not always a function of physical needs. Sometimes it's a little bit more than that. And I try wherever I can to do more than just satisfy the physical, to look after the emotional, to look after the mental, because we all absolutely need that as a community, as a person, as a human. You know, we need those other elements. And so the last is links, segues in. I work and live with acceptance as part of my day. Acceptance of others, but also acceptance of what I justly deserve based on the efforts I undertake for others and for myself. Writing the first part of that was easy. Accepting others, work that is a huge part that I do, and it's very comfortable to me to do. The second part, accepting what I justly deserve, not so easy. You know, knowing that I put the effort in, knowing that, like, you know, I want to do more and I find it hard to, you know, say thank you. You know, well, I will always say thank you, but I will always, like, I was like, oh, no, you don't have to. I'll just give. I'm a giver by nature. And that's why my cauldron tattoo is outpouring that way. But like anyone coming to the cauldron, like anyone coming to this, you know, place of abundance or satisfaction, you get what you deserve. You get what you're entitled to. And that is what you're entitled to. The story, one of the big stories linked with Dagda around this area of hospitality is very quickly him and Credenbale. So he's working under the rulership of Bress, digging these ditches. And every night he goes home to have his meal. And he is laboring very, very hard, heavy work, crafting the land and shifting the land. So he needs a hearty meal. But he's also hosting a Formorian filler by the name of Credenbale. And every day, Credenbale is like, here, Dagda, give us the 3 best portions of your meal. If you don't, I'll put a satire against you and tell everyone that your hospitality is terrible. And so Dagda's caught in this kind of catch-22. Like, he literally can't deny his guest hospitality. The guy's asking for a little bit much, but again, Dagda can't deny him. He's giving him the 3 best portions of his meal. And Dagda's health begins to diminish. He gets unwell. He's burning up all of his energy to craft and shape and protect the people with the land work he's doing, but he's not restoring that energy because his meal, his just meal, is being denied him. So eventually it leads to, you know, Dagda giving the best portions, which is 3 portions of his meal, which had a gold coin in each. Credenbale chokes to death. Leads to, long story short, the whole Moitura part 2, the Battle of the Fomorians. I can get into that and probably will get into that in another course, but it's that you have to have your just meal for the effort you're putting in. So he's laboring very, very hard, and he has to have enough to keep him going for that. Not too much. He's not looking for anything that, you know, is over and above. He's looking for what he needs to do the work. And so when I think of the cauldron, when I think of the hospitality element of that, you know, if you're doing the work, you deserve the rest. If you're doing the work, you deserve the meal, you know? And that is the balance that comes with the cauldron. That is the balance of that. And so if you're not putting the work in, if you're not putting the merits in, you know, you should be getting a smaller portion. And you should acknowledge that that is balance. That is the natural weight of things. So it's hard for me to accept, you know, anything really. I'm like, no, I don't need that. I don't want that. Even, you know, it's a challenge, shall I say, that I'm working on it. I really, really am. But it's that kind of, if you're putting the work in, acknowledge that you deserve what's coming to you. You know, if you're working really, really hard, you deserve your night's rest. You know, if you're out kind of laboring, if your body's going through something, like, you know, shifting, carrying, you know, whatever it actually is, you need to have the stuff to keep you fueled to do it. And again, not always food. You know, sometimes it might be you need to have the spiritual downtime. You know, you need to have the mental and emotional downtime, you know, to restore yourself, to be balanced, to be filled up, so your satisfaction carries you forward. My personal motto when I think in cauldron is, can I get you? If you're in and around me anytime, I'll probably at some point be like, can I get you? I'm making a cup of tea. Can I get you? So, practical use for the cauldron, and I'm aware we've ran over time. So practical use, when I view this, I view the cauldron as something I put energy or work into when I have it, knowing that I can achieve energy or rest from it when I don't. I see it as a support from which I can pour out what is best needed when it's needed. So talking about everything there, like the cauldron, kind of going through it, like, you don't get stew out of a cauldron unless you put something, the meat and the water and the veg in the cauldron, you know? So when you have the energy, put the work in. If you don't have the energy, you can't put the work in. But if you are storing up, if you're kind of doing what's needed, if you're kind of constantly in the state, if you're maintaining your cauldron, bit long, as in always full, then you'll always have enough. You'll always have what you need. And so the stuff that I do every day, you know, be it physical self-care, mental health care, is all putting stuff into that cauldron. It's charging my batteries. It's filling my cauldron. So it's always bit long. It's always full. It doesn't run dry. It doesn't run out. And then as I need it in cases like this, where I'm working really hard to kind of go through something that is a bit of a challenge to talk about, I can fall back on my cauldron. I can fall back on what I've invested in myself and the rest that I have taken to do what I need. Work when the work is there, rest when the work is not. You know, so it's about that balance. And again, the cauldron on my wrist pointing outwards towards my hand. Again, I'll hold it up. This is the open end, points out towards my hand. That to me is a visual outpouring. So as I kind of offer you my hand, or I offer it out, that's me pouring it out, you know, and that's me giving what I can give. And that is what the view with the cauldron. The other thing, and this thing has actually come to me quite recently, I've always had this habit of energetically defining space around me. And it's something I've often done for personal well-being. You know, you're in a state where you're not comfortable. You're in a state like when you're moving between places, you're in an environment where, you know, it's noisy, and you're just, I always have this, I've always been doing it. I referred to it initially as a bubble, and it's this kind of area of, no, this is my space. This is me. Anything outside this is not me, and has its relevance, has its importance, but it's not me. And I need to look after what's in here, which is me. And so I've always done this kind of organically or naturally for me. But quite recently, with going through and reading all the stuff since my evolution into diet work, sometimes it feels like a cauldron. It feels like I'm inside this vessel which surrounds me and kind of keeps me safe, you know? Or the term, this is the last part, a murius. It's a term I've personally coined, and it's a visualized area of protected space. It's warm. It's safe in the cauldron from the fortress of the pinnacles. Murius is a fortress. It's a protected space. No battle was ever, like, all battles were won outside of us. So for me, I visualize a Murius, you know, and that is what I do around myself and what I have often done around, you know, circumstances, scenarios. So if you ever are around me and suddenly it feels very, very comfortable, and you're just like, oh yeah, I'm just going to be, it's like, I've probably propped up a Murius powered by a cauldron. So that takes us to the end of the details of the cauldron. I'm just going to run on to just close it all off now. I know we've run over time, so take a few minutes just to close this off. Are there any questions at this point from anyone? Alastrina has asked that are guided meditations coming soon. I know someone who does guided meditations really, really, really well. Laura O'Brien, my business partner and thankfully my life partner. So she does a lot of kind of work with guided meditations and processes around that. It's not something I have gone into personally. A lot of my interactions tend to be something like this. So I don't really do guided meditations, but I do guided conversations. So it's something that people may be interested in, and I will take it on board and I'll look into it. Thanks very much for the idea. But I prefer conversations, the two-way kind of flow, the interconnected of it all. For 2019, I'll be popping back up with this, the sitting room sessions. So I did one yesterday, and it's going to be every month from my mailing list. A set space similar like this, except it's not just going to be me talking on the screen. It's going to be me and Laura. Pop yourself on camera, pop yourself on voice, interact as well, have a bit of a chat, you know. And I think that's where conversations kind of flow. So I'm less of a follow my voice kind of thing. I'm more of a let's talk and kind of get down into it. Let's find the questions. So anything there yesterday? The sitting room sessions will be recorded. Yeah. So yesterday's was recorded, and they will probably eventually make it up onto my YouTube channel, because apparently I need to have content there, because that is smart marketing and smart business with my business manager, partner, collaborator, Laura. So I did have a few questions myself, and I'm going to pop these up on the screen and see what you think. So the first thing that I noticed going through this process, we have all of these tools. Now, again, I've looked at the three main tools of the diagram, but there are other things. Like he has one pig that's always growing and one pig that's always roasting. You know, he has at the back of his home these fruit trees, which are always with fruit. So there's a lot of kind of stuff that's still around him. But I looked at the main three for this. But the thing that struck me is that we have an origin story for the club or the staff. We have an origin story for the cauldron out of Murius. We don't have an origin story for the harp. So is the harp the Dagda's first tool? It was an interesting one for me. The next question is a bit of an odd one and reminds me of the author Terry Pratchett with his kind of talk about witches and their hats. But Cur on Dagdi, is it the Dagda's cauldron because it's magic? Or is it magic because it's the Dagda's cauldron? We don't have much more beyond that, but does it have all these abundance and these powers because it belongs to him? Or is he the Dagda because he owns the cauldron? In some of the stories, like we're dealing with Moitura part one, or is it part two? I'm not quite sure. The cupbearers come in and the druids come in. They're listening. Oh, I'll do this and I'll bring this and I'll do this for the fight. And then Dagda turns around and goes, listen, lads, I'll just do everything you've said. I'll just do it. All right. And then all these kind of variety of kind of wise ones and powers, sorceresses and all the rest of it are like, geez, good on you. Yeah, you're the good god of druidry and wizardry. You're the Dagda. And he's like, yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that's paraphrased. But again, is the cauldron magic because it's the Dagda's, or is the Dagda magic because he has the cauldron? So interesting one to look at there. Next one actually occurred to me just within the last like few days of doing this work of creating this. Lorik Moore, a big staff or a great example? One of the translations of the word Lorik is example. And if we look at the backdrop of the story with the Lorik Moore, we have this Allahar, this deity, this kind of good god of druidry and power and wisdom with power over the land, sea, skies, and all the rest of it. But what's the crux of the story? It's not about any of that. It's about him mourning his child. It's about the loss of his son. And he does everything he can, but he doesn't have the power to bring back his child. And so he puts him up on his shoulders and carries him. He carries his child off out of Ireland to find a way to bring back his child. And when he eventually finds the way, he does whatever it takes. Whatever it takes. And unfortunately, it takes him into a dark place because he straight up murders the people to take the staff and use it. As soon as he does use it, his son Kermit is like, ah, hold on, that's not right. That's not on. That's not just. And he restores what was killed. Still not ideal, but he realizes what he needs to take on. He realizes that he needs to carry this power and take responsibility for it. So is it a magic stick that brings people back from the dead? Or is it a great example of being a father, owning yourself emotionally and owning your power, and then using it in the right ways to become the King of Ireland? I don't know. So all of these tools, all these three tools, they all share an underpinning. I touched on it earlier on, but it's worth coming back to. It's an underpinning of balance, support, rightness, or justice. If we look at the translations of all the words, Cor and Dagda, you know, the cauldron, but it's also rightness. Cor Cathair Cur, the rightness of four angles. Lorig, a support member, a staff, something to support a person, a balance between life and death. So all these kind of major items all link into this one individual, but they're all about the same thing, about balance, support, caring, rightness, and justice. So could it be said that all tales about Dagda are about what is right and how to achieve it. So I'd like to thank you very much for joining me for this presentation. As I said, I knew we went over a little bit of time there. That does take us to a close. You can find me, harpandclub.blogspot.com. Actually, I need to update to that to dagdabard.com. So I launched my website in 2018. Patreon.com/Dagda, Shkeli Bjork on Facebook, and also at dagdabard on Instagram. And I'm working to share my life in photographs with people going forward. So is there any questions at this point? And I'll kind of just sit with you in the chat and we'll have a quick look at that there. Let's see. So yeah, these classes are recorded and will be uploaded. Again, having attended live, you will have access to the recorded class, but also thank you very much for anyone who's joined us and kind of taking the download of it as well. Let's see. Okay. So, yeah, Sally Rose Robinson, I guess it's in regard to the harp, you know, is the harp his first tool? Could it be that he created it himself, like, you know, or created it for himself? Or is that the cauldron? You know, is it a case that the Dagda, well, no, it actually says that Semmius made the cauldron. So there is a reference to Semmius actually for making the cauldron or being involved with that. But is the harp Dagda's first tool? Is it something he made himself? Given that he's skilled with all of the things that prove someone to be the best of best harpers, maybe that. Sally, again, the balance of being in right relationship with the land, sea, and sky, and the people. Yeah, so it's kind of very crucial. And every time we find a dad in the stories, he's doing something to support the people. He's either building the land, he's kind of like digging the ditches to protect people, he's playing the music, he's buried into the middle of a battle, he's kind of calling out the incorrect king on, you know, his poor judgment, really, which sets off Moitura Part 2. But he's everywhere doing something for other people. His son Angus comes to him like, I need to sort this stuff out, and Dad is like, okay, well, literally, I will clear the plains for you. And he does it in a night. He doesn't a day and a night, you know, he gets rid of sea monsters. All of this is for taking care of other people. So he is everywhere because maybe from my view, maybe it's something my own, again, Dagda world view, because he's in right relationship, because he focuses on what's just, on what's right, on this caring for other people and being in harmony, he's empowered. He is hugely powerful to do all of these things in every single way, anywhere. So, you know, everything he does seems to be in service of other people. Let's see. Okay, was there any other questions there? Sorry. A question. So Alistrina was aware of the three strains. Is there a fort to which, just to say it was worded, or is it that there are three strains unknown? The to which that was mentioned in the text is like the, it's a way of saying which are, kind of. It's like, you know, we're going to mention the three. There are three strains to it, which are. And then it lists out the three different strains, the names of them. So it's an awareness to say, okay, well, it's that emotional kind of the joy strain, the sorrow strain, and the sleep strain. So it's kind of take people on and say, okay, well, this is what they fit in. And these are how they're manifest. Again, it really, really like touched me to, like all of those experiences, all those emotional experiences, joy, sadness and weeping and sleep is what a woman goes through as they're trying to birth a child, as far as I understand. And it's that kind of hugely powerful and emotional experience that in the story is represented in these magical ways. So I do have another possible theory. Maybe the Dagda's magic around this is to try and help other people to experience what it's like to go through one of the most challenging and amazing experiences a body can go through. And is it a case that like everyone is enriched and made better because they have experienced the joy, they've experienced the sadness and the pain, and at the end of it all, they get a really, really good night's sleep. You know, and it's entirely possible that more people need to have an understanding of what what that really is and how that is so challenging for a person to experience, but then also coming through something like that is so empowering, as far as I understand. So I don't know. That's a really good one, right? Lessons from the Dagda. Yeah, I would agree with that, Sally. So it's, you know, about being in the right relationship and like the service to the people, to kind of go forward with that. Let's see. Laura has said the Dagda helps us with our humanity. Yeah, absolutely, in my opinion. Okay, so there we go. We ran a little bit over time. Thank you very, very much for turning up. I do really, really appreciate your company and companionship. You know where to find me. It's on the screen there as well. And I will say thank you very much. And I will bid you adieu and goodbye for now.